Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Katsmita. Every week I am joined with Brent Johnson, the man behind the Dollar Milkshake Theory. Now, if you do not know what that is, I encourage you to visit milkshakespod.com, the website for this show. There's more information there and plenty of links to send you down the rabbit hole. Now, the thing about the Dollar Milkshake Theory, at least for this episode, is there's different ways that people sometimes perhaps accidentally interpret what is being said. So in this conversation, Brent and I go a little deeper into the Dollar Milkshake Theory and some of the things where he thinks people misinterpret or make mistakes as to what the story or narrative is trying to explain. And throughout that process, I propose a few questions for Brent that he answered brilliantly. You know, personally for me, this is one of the most fun conversations I've had with him when it comes to financial markets, both on camera and off camera, and I think everyone's going to enjoy it a whole lot, because I certainly did. So please, if you are new to the show, strap in, and especially if you're new to the Dollar Milkshake Theory, I think Brent does a great job of peeling back some of the layers of the onion that even if you are a fan of or familiar with Brent and his work, you're still going to, I think, gain quite a bit from this new conversation that he and I had. So let's get started. Welcome again to Milkshakes Markets Madness.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
I drink your milkshake.
Hey, Brent, how you doing, my friend?
I'm good. Good to see you again. Getting cold down there, huh?
It is. It's almost time to flee down under and come back to the balmy conditions of El Caribe. Look, man, there's been some interesting stuff going on, but overall, it's kind of a repeat of various themes we've talked about, and I think we can dive a little deeper on some of those, but instead of being somewhat redundant, I figured we'd, because they all kind of coincide and represent the Dollar Milkshake Theory in a lot of ways. They're various pillars of that story, but one of the things I've noticed, and we've talked about this, is, you know, people go on their journey, right? I think this is one of the reasons people really gravitate towards your financial opinions and really appreciate the Dollar Milkshake Theory and how it has kind of opened their eyes to how the financial system works. But what ends up happening is they kind of have this aha moment. They see what's going on, how, you know, the role the U.S. dollar plays, maybe some of the corrosion and corruption in the global financial system. And they start to have this like woke moment, if you will, dare I say that word. And once they start to connect the dots, they are able to kind of put together, partly because of what the Dollar Milkshake Theory lays out, they're able to put together what the ultimate end game potentially looks like. But then they immediately rush to the finish line, right? They connect all the dots in their head. So then immediately they think tomorrow this is going to happen. And last week, you kind of introduced this idea of like a what if. Right. You know, if this debt ceiling drama continues, Yellen could, you know, maybe do this nuclear option. And we talked about MMT a little bit. But to that concept, I mean, we're nowhere near to them even executing that strategy. So do you want to talk about, now that I've kind of laid that up, the timeline piece of your theory and just your overall macro view on markets?
Yeah. And this comes up a lot. A lot of times when I'm talking to people at conferences or when I'm speaking to new potential clients on the phone or whatever it is, you know, it inevitably comes up that we talk about the milkshake thesis, or they heard me on this podcast and they've heard my views on the dollar. And it's kind of interesting. I get invited to go to a lot of different gold conferences or precious metals conferences. And I get invited there for a couple of reasons. One is because I'm very bullish long-term on gold, and they know my views on gold. But I'm also kind of invited because I'm the one token guy that talks about the dollar, right? And so they want to have a little bit of a, you know, diversity of opinion rather than just everybody screaming hyperinflation, right? And so then I will often get asked, well, Brent, how come you don't talk about gold that much? You'll say that everybody should own it, and you'll say that you think it's going higher, but then you don't talk about it much further than that. And part of the reason that I don't talk about it as much is I don't think I need to talk about it that much. And what I mean by that is, to me, that's kind of the end game scenario, or I own gold for the end game scenario. I don't own gold for chapters 4 through 6. Now, it doesn't mean that gold won't go up through chapters 4 through 6 or 7 or whatever it is, but I kind of think that, you know, I've said many times that I think we will ultimately get into a scenario where the gold and dollar and probably U.S. equities are all rallying together. And then in the final stages, gold will, you know, the dollar will fall and gold will be the winner. But I think that's a long way off, right? And so I don't think I need to focus on the final chapter, because I think what's more pressing and what's more actually going to help people make it to the final chapter is helping them understand, you know, I think maybe we're in chapter 4 or 5 of a 10 chapter book, or, you know, I think there's a number of chapters that happen before we get into that final scenario. Now, I know that it's possible that I'll wake up tomorrow and that final scenario plays out. So maybe we're going to speed read through chapter 6 through 9 and chapter 10 is going to come really quickly. So you have to be ready for it. But that's not my belief. I think we probably have at least another 3 or 4 years, maybe another 5 or 10 years before this whole, you know, game or, you know, scenario plays out. And I've said, you know, in my talks with Peter Schiff and my debates with him about, you know, the dollar and the gold, and, you know, I've oftentimes said that I think Peter's probably the best person in the world at explaining where we're going to end up and why we're going to end up there, but that I disagree with him on the path to that, you know, final destination. And I think there's a lot of people out there who kind of understand the end game. There's a lot of people kind of in the gold world or the precious metals world who have explained the dangers of fiat currency and, you know, why you need to have hard assets. And while I think I can talk on that stuff probably as well as anybody, I don't feel like I'm necessarily adding a lot of value to that, because it's kind of already been said, right? And for most people, I think they should just buy some physical gold, have that as part of their portfolio, and kind of forget about it. Not necessarily worry about it every day and think about it every day. Now, I know most people in the gold world or who are precious metals bulls, you know, literally they wake up and they look at gold the first thing in the morning, and they look at it before they go to bed. And the reality is that's the first thing I look at when I wake up in the morning. When I look at my phone, the first thing in the morning, I'm checking financial markets. The first thing I look at is the gold price. Mainly because I think it's a temperature gauge on what the hell's going on in the world. You know, if you wake up and gold's up $40, something happened, right? Or if it's down $40, then you know something happened. So that's one of the reasons I do it. But I think in many cases people focus on the end game too much, and as a result, the chapters that lead up to it is where they could get tripped up along the way. So, you know, I don't know if that kind of helps set the stage for what we're going to talk about today or not, but I think that's why I don't kind of harp on gold all the time, even though I'm a big gold bull.
Yeah, so I'm going to pick up the baton from where you just left off there in a minute. But you said something that I want to kind of backtrack on. And you had talked about potentially maybe we're in chapter 4 or 5 of a, you know, 10 chapter story, who knows. And you even, you know, said, hey, maybe this is a 5-year, 10-year timeline. When you started to crystallize this narrative around what you were figuring out and identifying in the market, and you made the dollar milkshake theory, when would you say kind of the birth at least of the theory was? And at that time, were you saying to yourself, okay, this is a 5 to 10 year phenomenon? And the reason I ask that, because are we now 10 years in, and instead of being in the final chapter, only in chapter 5, and how has that maybe affected your patience, so to speak, when waiting to see some of these things unfold?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I started kind of coming around to the idea of the dollar getting stronger probably in 2015 or 16. And the reason I did it was because in the middle of 2014, Raul Powell, he's somebody who believes in gold long-term as well. He thinks gold is going to go a lot higher for many of the same reasons I do. But in the summer of 2014, he started telling me the dollar was going to get much stronger. And I was like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. The dollar is not going to get any stronger. They're going to have to print it forever. It's going to get inflated away and gold's going to go to $5,000. And sure enough, the dollar went on a huge run in the second half of 2014. I don't remember how much it went up, but I think it went up like 10% in 6 months or something like that. And I was like, what is going on? First of all, how did he know that? And how did I get it so wrong? And I started talking to some of my other friends and contacts in the gold world, and they didn't want to talk about it. And they were like, oh, it's just a short-term thing. It's an aberration. It's going to go down. And I just didn't like that answer. So I was like, I have to go back in and dig into it. So that's when I kind of started on that path. And I didn't really get to the whole quote unquote milkshake theory. And I should say, I didn't wake up one day and have the whole solution, right? This has been like a long running process. And every day, every day, sometimes much to my chagrin, I have to think about it more and incorporate new, you know, probabilities or new things that have happened. But I would say the first time I ever mentioned the word publicly and mentioned it in the context of this theory was the first part of 2018. And then the first like presentation or interview I gave when I kind of really kind of spelled it out was, I think, June of 2018. So it's been about 5 years. And at that time, to your point, I said I thought it would take 4 or 5 years to play out. So here we are, 5 years into it. And it's started to play out a little bit, but, you know, like you said, I think we probably got at least another 5 years to go. And it could. And at the time I said I thought it would be 5 to 10 years. But now I think it's another 5 to 10 years, even though we're 5 to 10 years in. Part of the reason was that it started to play out in 2020 with COVID, right? And when COVID first hit, well, here's the interesting thing. I think had COVID not hit, I think we still would have had a crisis. Because I think of all the debt in the world, I think I'm just somebody who believes that at some point you're going to hit the wall with debt. There was a number of maturities, you know, emerging market debt maturities that were hitting kind of in the 2021 to 2023 timeframe. There was a number of other stuff even in the U.S. that was going to happen. And so I kind of felt like that was the kind of the farthest out it would go. And then when COVID hit in 2020, I thought, okay, this is the trigger that's going to, you know, make all that stuff even worse than I had initially thought it would be. But what actually happened was because it was kind of a, I don't know, let's just call it a globally systemic event, for lack of a better way of saying it. Now, perhaps you believe that it wasn't, and perhaps you believe it's all fake and whatever, but regardless of your views on the whole COVID thing, there's no denying that the world, for the most part, kind of worked together to quote unquote solve the issue, right? Now, whether they were solving it, whether they were just implementing it for their own, you know, benefit, you know, that's open to your interpretation. But global monetary policy was largely the same. Social policy was largely the same. Medical policy was largely the same everywhere in the world. And, you know, up until then, or I would say from like 2000, well, when Trump got elected, it was 2016. And probably around 2018, the world stopped. They started to kind of bump heads a little bit, right? And so we'd had this big mass globalization effort for decades, and then it's, you know, we started to get into the Trump trade wars with China and some other things. So the cooperation kind of started to break a little bit. But then COVID hit, and everybody, again, because it was kind of this globally systemic thing, everybody kind of cooperated. And I feel like when they did that, they kicked the can down the road a couple of years. And so whereas I initially thought that COVID was going to speed up the whole process, in hindsight, I got that wrong. And I think it actually helped kick it down the road and allowed the, you know, the powers that be to kind of delay the inevitable, so to speak. And so that's part of the reason why I think it didn't happen in my timeline. And now the reason that I think it could take a little bit longer is I've learned a lot in the last 4 or 5 years, and I've learned more about different kinds of monetary policy. I've learned different ways that the government could kick the can down the road further. And I've always known that this could take longer than I thought. But when you see how long it actually takes to play out, you realize that, you know, maybe it takes another 5 or 10 years. But part of that is what we kind of started talking about last time when we were talking about these MMT policies. Now, I think it was probably 4 or 5 years ago now that Stephanie Kelton kind of picked up on Warren Mosler's work, you know, regarding MMT, and kind of, you know, she wrote the book about it, and she started doing, you know, presentations and interviews, and the whole MMT thing kind of picked up speed. And for a little bit there, you kind of thought they were going to start implementing those policies. And what I mean by that is MMT at its core is really a description of the way things work. It's actually not a prescription of way of things that could be done, but a lot of people will read the descriptions that Kelton and Mosler talk about, who I think accurately describe how the system actually works. And then they will take that and they will put a prescription of way they think monetary policy should be run based on those concepts. And that's where things can kind of get a little silly. And that's where I think a lot of people immediately go to the end game and they say, no, that can't be done because that will lead to hyperinflation and all these other problems. And the thing is I think when you take it to its logical conclusion, that is where that stuff kind of ultimately ends up. But that can take a long time to get there. Just because if they were to implement some MMT policies, right? I think a lot of people say, oh, that's going to lead to high levels of inflation and a number of economic problems, and it's going to end really badly. But it won't end badly really right away. And if you need any proof, just go back to, I mean, we're 15 years in from the global financial crisis. Think of everything they've done since then. How many QE programs have they done? How many bailouts have they done? How many liquidity injections have they done? How many helicopter drops have they done? And yet, it's still going, right? And so I think if you open your mind and you're just honest about it, you know, a number of these things that many people thought would have already led to the end game have happened. And yet governments, for the most part, are still functioning. Now, cracks are starting to show, but for the most part, they're still running. And the other thing I would say is that, and so that's part of the reason why I don't think it's happening yet. And that's why I think I still think there's a number of things that governments and monetary authorities can do to keep the game going. A lot of times people will say the Fed is out of bullets. There's nothing more they can do. All they can do is print. I disagree with that. I think there's many, many things that they can do. But then the other thing to remember is that I don't think that all of this stuff, it's not just the U.S. we're talking about. Again, I always talk about this is a relative thing. So if that stuff eventually does come to the U.S., which I admit that it could eventually come to that, I think it's going to come everywhere else first. So I think, you know, MMT policies are much more likely to show up in Japan in mass before they show up in mass in the United States or in Europe or in China or in Russia or wherever it is. So it's not that it can't happen here. It can, but it can happen elsewhere first. And we haven't even really seen it to a great, great extent elsewhere yet. You know, and then the other part of it is that for 50 years, and this brings back to gold a little bit, And the reason I'm coming back to gold right now is with the debt ceiling here, this idea of the platinum coin, you know, has come back up, or, you know, remonetize gold in order to solve the debt problem. Now, the reason that I don't think this is going to happen anytime soon, although I understand how it could happen and why it could happen, is because for 50 years, the central banks around the world and the governments around the world, for the most part, have tried to demonetize gold, get gold out of the monetary system. They've tried to kind of delegitimize it, you know, for lack of a better way of saying, oh, if anybody wants gold, oh, they're a crazy gold bug, you know. And if you don't think that's real, I think that is real. I think they've waged a campaign to demonetize and delegitimize gold over the last 50 years, and I think they've been largely successful in doing it. So for them to just automatically come out next week or 2 weeks from now at the Fed meeting and said, you know what, we've solved all of our problems, we're going to remonetize gold at $20,000 and, you know, everything's going to be solved. I think it's just not reality, right? You know, they may do that at some point, but that's going to be like as a last ditch effort when they have exhausted every other opportunity. And I just think there's a lot of other things they can do before it gets to that. And I think all those things could take several years before it comes to that. Now, that doesn't mean that gold can't go to $5,000 before they actually put it back into the monetary system or before they use it as some way to kind of, you know, recollateralize the system. And that's what I've always said, is that I don't think that we're going back to a gold standard anytime soon, and probably not ever. But it doesn't mean that gold won't go up a lot anyway. And so that's why I want to own it, because whether they bring it back in and re-legitimize it or not, gold will still put itself forth as a possible solution. So it's kind of all that stuff put together of why I think we could still have 5 or 10 years to go. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, a lot of people will say, but Brent, that just doesn't make sense. You know, you can't just keep kicking the can down the road. It's non-economic. And so I agree with you, but, you know, communism in many ways doesn't make sense either. And the communist system doesn't make a lot of sense either. But the Soviet ruble lasted for 50 or 60 years. So, you know, the idea that just because something doesn't make sense doesn't mean it can't last is historically provably wrong. And it's for many of these reasons that I think you got to understand and keep an open mind about what can happen, again, in chapters 5 through 9, rather than just focusing on number 10. Anyway, that was a very long tirade, soapbox, whatever you want to call it. But that's kind of why I think it could take a lot longer.
Yeah, good. I mean, it's good to kind of have that comprehensive overview of partly where you've come and also the fact that you're aware of these other factors, but it's, you know, it really does answer the question I proposed of, you know, where are we on this timeline and why are we at that place in the timeline? And again, we don't know. There's something we hammer on a lot about, which is this isn't a matter of certainty. It's more a matter of conviction. And we're all kind of just trying to navigate as the ocean moves us back and forth. But while we're on kind of this topic of the governments, what they can do, some of those responses and coordinated responses that were used during 2020. And it's something that, you know, you're referencing with the MMT got me thinking about. And it's, I want to speak specifically, so we don't get too off the rails, about the U.S. because the U.S. as the reserve currency, ultimately for things to work, I feel like needs to be running deficits. They're uniquely capable of doing that. But what is specifically with the U.S. when you're talking about MMT, the real role potentially of government debt and specifically taxation, because many would argue, and I kind of feel like this ideologically, that, you know, tax doesn't need to really exist. And we kind of proved that to some extent in 2020, because governments everywhere were just monetizing the debt. And now you're bringing up this issue with the debt ceiling. Oh, we can't issue more bonds. Well, Yellen could come along and just send money out everywhere, and the central bank could offset the inflationary impact by continuing to raise rates and various forms of QT. So why is debt, why do we even need debt in that environment? And therefore, why do we need taxation outside of maybe providing the world a financial instrument in which they can access dollar liquidity?
So it's an excellent question, and it kind of goes to the heart of everything. And it's such a big topic, though, that I got to figure out the right way to frame this so that it's understandable in a simple manner. So there's kind of two parts here. What's the right way? Maybe the right way. Let's think about this like at Christmas time, right? Now, there's two stories that are told. There's one household where the dad and mom, they're just brutally honest. And they say, yeah, there is no Santa Claus, but we're going to go along with the game. And when you wake up on Saturday morning or Christmas morning, there's going to be some presents under the tree. But don't believe any of that ridiculous hokum that your friends are telling you about some, you know, fat guy in a red suit coming down the chimney, right? And in the other household, they're saying, oh, this is amazing. One time a year, this fat guy in a suit comes flying around on his magic sleigh, and he drops down into the chimneys while you're asleep, and he leaves presents for you, and he's been listening to everything you've done all year, right? But the reality is either way, there's presents under the tree the next morning, right? And you can kind of choose which story to believe, but the reality is Christmas morning, there's the presents. It's kind of like that with the monetary system. And what I mean by that is you can kind of dress it up and pretend it's a little bit nicer and prettier than what it actually is. And I don't know this for sure, but I think what Warren Mosler and Stephanie Kelton would say is that the fact that we borrow money from the public and then we use that to then pay for goods and services is much like, it's the way we dress it up to make it look like we're actually somewhat responsible, as opposed to just telling you this is how we're doing it, right? Because, you know, what they would say is the government doesn't need to borrow money. They can just spend it into existence. And then people would say, okay, that's very inflationary. You can't just spend it into existence, because if you just keep spending it, there'll be more and more of it, and therefore that would be very inflationary. Okay, that's true. So what, you know, the MMTers will say then, well, the way you keep the supply from just growing at an absurd rate and leading to high inflation is you take some of that supply back every year. And you take it back either in the form of debt that you're selling to them, or you take it back in the form of taxes. And you regulate the supply that way. And the reality is it's kind of the chicken and the egg, which came first, right? Where does the government get money? Well, they get it from the people by taxing them. Okay, well, where did the people get the money? Well, they got it from the government. In other words, nobody walked out one day and found, just out of the blue, found a dollar bill on the ground, right? The government had to create that money and put it into the system. So now I know that there's people out there saying, yeah, but that's not real money. That's currency. Only gold is money. Okay. Then we get back to this, what's really money? Is gold money or is fiat currency money? And I think in order to survive chapters 5 through 9, and I keep coming back to this, I think you have to see things from both point of views, because there's going to be times where one or the other is going to be the prevailing view, and you're going to have to understand how that works in order to survive the challenges that come in those chapters. So I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I hope this makes sense. So you've got the two systems. One is like you've got money that's decided by the market, which is gold. That's everybody decided to use gold because gold has value. And in the other system, you have fiat currency where the government said this is what you're going to use. One of them is regulated by the supply of gold, and the other one is regulated by the tax impact or the treasury debt of the government, right? But both of them are regulated either by nature or by law, by diktat from the government. Okay, so I'm trying to think of the right way to a good analogy to use. Okay, so both systems are accurate. Just like the parents putting the presents under the tree, and the fact that there's going to be presents there, you know. If you never found out that there wasn't a Santa Claus, in your reality, that's the way it works, right? And I think many people don't like the MMT story because they don't like revealing that that's actually the way it works. And in some ways, that's kind of hard to get your head around. Whereas, you know, the MMT suppliers are saying, or the MMT proponents are saying, well, this ridiculousness about the debt ceiling is it's totally nonsensical. It's putting handcuffs on us that we don't need to have. Governments are not like households. They play from a it's like somebody at the blackjack table. The players are not the same as the dealers, right? The players are not the same as the house. You have to look at it from a different point of view. And all of these types of, you know, fiscal policies that we try to put on the government are really just window dressing when we don't really need to think of it that way. Now, again, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with all this. I'm just saying these are the two different ways you have to look at it. One of the things that's kind of helped me think about it this way is, let's pretend you got thrown in prison. You did something bad and you got thrown in prison. And you walk in there and you're scared you're scared out of your mind. You don't know how anything works. But then, you know, after you settle down, you kind of start looking around, you see, you know, the different prisoners are trading sardines back and forth among themselves. And somebody wants a magazine, they hand them a pack of sardines or whatever it is. And you finally figure out that, you know, whatever money is in prison is what the biggest, baddest guy says it is. And if that's what you use as currency, then that's what's used as currency. Now, I would love it if somebody got through. I would love to be able to videotape a gold bug getting thrown in jail, you know, trying to get a magazine in prison, and the big bad guy says, well, you need to give me a can of sardines, and the gold bug tries to explain to the big good bad guy that sardines aren't really money. What you really need is gold. Right? Well, it doesn't matter if you think gold is money. The big bad guy doesn't think gold is money, and he can't get access to gold. So you've got to pay me in my sardines. And if you don't pay me in my sardines, really, really bad things are going to happen. Well, that's kind of how a country is. Think of a country like a prison, right? Now, some countries are nicer prisons than other prisons, you know, and some are locked down really tight. You can't even get out of your cell for very many hours a day. And, you know, you got to do what the prison guards say, and you got to follow the rules of the big bad guys and the gangs in prison. Other prisons are a little bit more, you have a little bit more leeway. You don't have to stay in your cell every day. You can go out and you go out to the recreation yard and you go lift weights, and some of them even have work release programs. You can leave for a little while. You can go somewhere else for a little while, but you got to come back at the end of the day, you know? That's kind of like when you get your passport stamped and you go to Spain. Well, at some point you got to come back. And if you don't come back, then, you know, you're in trouble. So I guess my point is you got to learn, even though you understand fundamentally why gold would be decided to be money if we had a free market, it's important to understand that we do not have a free market. And you have to play by the rules of the big bad guys. Now, you don't have to play by the rules, but you at least better understand their rules in order to survive. Because if you just ignore their rules, they will come find you, right? And so that's why I say we can get into this situation where all of these things can be going on in the prison, and the big bad guys and the gangs can be putting all these different policies in place. Maybe some of them make sense, maybe some of them don't. And outside the walls of the prison, there's a stack of gold, and maybe it's going up in value every day, but that's not the reality you live in, right? You live in the reality where there's walls and there's rules, and the big bad guys are going to come take you if you don't follow those rules. And that's why I think it's important to understand both sides, because it's fine if your gold stack is going up in value, but unless you're going to sell it, what good is it doing you when you're acting in the regular everyday environment, right? And if you're in prison and you have this big stack of gold hidden outside the walls that you, once you get outside the walls, you can go collect that, you still have to survive the rules inside the walls until you can break out and get to it. And we live in this world with walls. And unfortunately, the people that are running these places are losing control. And as they lose control, they're going to start to try to clamp down even harder. And I think that they are going to be able to remain in control due to their tightening of restrictions, or however you want to say it, longer than many people think they're going to. And it's fine for you to have this escape hatch outside the walls, but you better understand the rules of the game inside, or you're not going to survive to get to it. And that's what, so I feel like I spend a lot of my time talking about what's going on inside the walls, even though I know that many people want to get outside the walls and go pick up that, that stack of gold that they have, or the Bitcoin, or whatever escape hatch they have. So again, that was a very long, rambling kind of analogy, but I hope it sort of makes sense.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun conversations, both I think on camera for the show and just off air. That one was a good one for me. I've never heard you kind of on the spot like that crystallize that analogy, and I think it was brilliantly done. I like the Santa Claus. I like the jail or prison reference. I'm a little disappointed you didn't sneak in a Attack on Titan reference when you started talking about the walls.
You know, so, what? Yeah. Honestly, it's funny you say that, John. If everybody wants to understand what the hell's going on in the world, you should watch the Attack on Titan.
Yeah, so Attack on Titan is an anime series, and make sure you block out a huge chunk of time to watch it, because it's funny talking about that, because as you're explaining in this conversation how the timeline can go much longer than you think, I think Attack on Titan somehow just went way longer than you ever expected.
That is a perfect analogy. Just when you think it's about over, just when you about think you understand what's going on, there's a whole paradigm shift.
Oh,
exactly. That's a perfect analogy. Go watch Attack on Titan.
There you go. So what is the what's the quote or saying in your Twitter bio about magic?
Oh, you either believe in math or you believe in magic. And the point with all this is that eventually the math is going to play out. All of this debt, all of the crazy shenanigans that are going on will collapse, for lack of a better way of saying it. But it can go on a really long time. And so I think it's important to understand the math, but you also have to kind of appreciate the magic, right? And you know, the politicians and the monetary authorities, they're fantastic magicians.
So, and not every magician is a good magician, which kind of leads a little bit, or at least references a little bit to one of the parts of the dollar milkshake theory with prestige and some of the stuff that goes on between these battling magicians. And with that in mind, you also have in the end game of the dollar milkshake theory this Highlander reference. And as you're kind of explaining these things, you just, in case people didn't pick up on the analogy, the bully in the prison at this stage of the story is the United States. And do you want to kind of highlight a little bit why you're creating these analogies and using characters like Santa Claus and whatnot, who in that Highlander reference is more or less playing the U.S.?
Yeah, I've always, you know, I've probably mentioned this before, but in my whole career, I've always worked with individuals. And so I've always tried to come up with somewhat kind of silly or simple analogies that will kind of help explain what I'm talking about. And when I started talking about dollars and gold, I started using this Highlander reference. And Highlander's this movie, this really horrible movie from the 80s that I loved growing up. And even though it's a really bad movie, I still love it. And essentially, it's about these immortals that, the, you know, there's a handful of immortals that live on the around the world, and, you know, they can only be killed by another immortal. And, you know, I thought that the you know, as we move towards this, you know, and in this movie at the end, they all come together and they have this big battle, and there's these final two fighting, and the last person standing kind of wins the prize. And I thought that was a good analogy for a currency crisis, because, you know, currencies are big and they're powerful, and, you know, but the reality is that, you know, one of them is going to be stronger than all the others. And then gold, I think, in many ways is a currency, and it's immortal, and you kind of can't kill gold. And so what I use, so in the movie, there was the bad guy was called the Kurgan, and the good guy was called McLeod. And so the analogies I've used was that the United States dollar is the Kurgan, and gold is McLeod. And those two are ultimately going to have a showdown kind of at the very end of the movie. And I think gold will win just the way McLeod won in the movie. But what happened again in chapters 5 through 6 is that the Kurgan went around cutting off everybody else's head. And I think that's what the dollar is going to do to all these other currencies, right? And you can see it's already started to do it. That's why the dollar, despite all of these crazy monetary policies of the last 15 years, was at a 30-year high last year. Despite all of the bailouts and despite all the liquidity injections, we have not had dollar hyperinflation. Have we had high inflation? Sure, but we have not had anything close to hyperinflation despite everything. And so to me, that's the Kurgan going around and causing all these problems. And the reason that the reason I used the Kurgan as the dollar rather than making because I think the dollar is going to be very strong and very hard to beat, right? I could have used Superman and because it's the US dollar, I could use Superman as the analogy. But the reason I didn't use Superman is because I'm not advocating that what the US is doing is right. I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, the US dollar is representative of truth and justice and, you know, divine morality. In many ways, I don't think morality or truth or justice has anything to do with it. I think this is kind of the big game. And all the players are going to do whatever they possibly can and to win, you know, regardless of whether it's right, whether it's wrong, whether it's moral or immoral. You know, I think all of the tools are going to be used. And I think the Kurgan is going to, that's why I use the Kurgan. If I thought that this was the way it should be and that this was the right way and that this was the most moral way to do it, then I would have used somebody like Superman or Spider-Man. But I didn't. I used the Kurgan because he's just a badass that goes around and doesn't really care. And that's kind of the way the global hegemon acts. You know, the global hegemon doesn't really care what anybody else thinks. You might want them to. Again, you might want him to be in a, you know, jolly old guy in a red suit who comes down the chimney and just hands you presents. But he's probably, you know, not that's probably not the right analogy. And so what I've tried to do with all of this is rather than, you know, just say, hey, everything's going to be all right, buy gold and everything's going to be fine, is that I've tried to bring a little bit of, you know, and not saying, you know, you could do all, the rest of the world can de-dollarize and they can do all these things and the big bad bully is going to fall on the playground with a bloody nose and everybody else is going to go off and, you know, play basketball. Well, I just don't think that's the way it's going to happen, right? And I'm trying to bring a little bit of reality to the world rather than this fantasy that, you know, the world's going to rise up, punch the U.S. in the nose, and then everything's going to change. I just don't think that's the way it's going to be. I think we're going to have to deal with the Kurgan for many years to come.
You know, while we're on this character theme, I think one of the funniest and most toxic characters created is Cartman on South Park. He's just such a twisted, evil person. Yeah. And there's a old school episode where he's like mocking that like sassy girl who's on like Dr. Phil or one of these shows. And he's going around, I do what I want. I don't care. I do what I want. So we've got quite a few character analogies on this one. We got the Kurgan, we got Cartman, we got Santa, we got the prison bully. You know, look, if you've made it this far, I can pretty much guarantee, and it's not boasting, that you took something valuable from this conversation. It was a really enjoyable one for me. So if you're with us still, please, if you're on YouTube, hit the subscribe button, give us a thumbs up and a like, maybe leave us a comment. We enjoy having conversations in the threads when we can. But Brent, I appreciate you coming on. Everybody, this is Milkshakes Markets Madness. You can find us on Twitter and on YouTube at the handle Milkshakes Pod. Brent is at Twitter for Santiago AU Fund. I'm at John Kutzmita. We appreciate you. And if you want to learn more about the things we were discussing here and the dollar milkshake theory, you can find out all you need to know at milkshakespod.com. Brent, I appreciate you, man. That was very informative. Thanks for your time.
Cool. Good talking to you, buddy. I hope everybody has a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.